So good evening, everybody. Here's what I want to do tonight. I looked at the calendar and I realized that Hanukkah is soon upon us. And while I feel confident that we're going to have another class related to Hanukkah, I think it's appropriate that we have two classes on it. And I want to tell you what two different understandings. Tonight we'll do one, and then next class we'll do something else. But I wanted to start
Just
early.
start early.
I'll tell you why. In Judaic literature, it tells us an incredible thing. If I were to ask you, name me the top two spiritually infused holidays on the Jewish calendar, what would you choose? I know they're all important. I know. I'm asking you an impossible question. But knee-jerk reaction, don't think too much about it. What would you say?
Rosh
I
Hashanah and
would
Yom
say
Kippur.
right, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. I would even lump them together, the high holiday season. And what else?
Shabbos.
Okay, Shabbos is true. That's true.
Sukkot.
Shavuot.
Sukkot.
Purim. We got Purim. We got Sukkot.
Shavuot.
Shavuos. Okay. None of these answers are wrong. But here's what I found. I found written in some of the Svarim, in some of the books, that the spiritual energy that comes down to the world during Hanukkah is equal or perhaps even surpasses the spiritual influence of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which is to me was astounding because let's call a spade a spade. Hanukkah, as great as it is only, and I put that in quotes, is only a rabbinic holiday. It is not in the Torah. Rosh Hashanah is in the Torah, Yom Kippur, Shavuot, Sukkot. Most of the holidays mentioned are biblical command, big biblical holidays. Hanukkah is not. Yet the spiritual energy of Hanukkah is equal to at least that of Rosh Hashanah. And someone asked the question in one of the books that I was reading. Basic question: how can it be? Rosh Hashanah is, I mean, we spend a month of Elul preparing for the high holidays. That's what Elul is supposed to be. The month prior to Rosh Hashanah, we're supposed to be doing introspection. We're supposed to be improving and rectifying any of the mistakes we made over the year. Okay. Other than buying oil and making sure your menorah slash Chanukiah is clean and polished, what kind of preparation do we do? We don't spend months beforehand. At least typically we don't. Maybe we should, but how can it be? He asked, and he gave such a beautiful insight. If I were to ask you, why do we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? Why? I know the answer is because that's a mitzvah. That's what Hashem told us to do. But we've been taught that it really represents, there's a deep symbolism about blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and it is, for what reason?
To wake us up.
Wake up call.
Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to be a wake-up call. It's like the alarm is going off, and you're like, OMG, I got to get my affairs in order here. I got to get going. It's a new year, and there's so much at stake. However, if you want to use the analogy of the person who's sleeping, right? Whether he's physically sleeping or spiritually sleeping, your job is to awaken them. You have two ways to do that. This was the parable, the mashal that he gave. You have two ways that you can wake up your friend who's sleeping. One is you can blow a loud sound and awaken him with an alarm. That's the shofar. But there's another way to do it, and that is you
Turn
turn on
off
the
the
lights.
lights.
Yeah, you turn on the lights. You put on a couple of spotlights right on him, and yeah, more often than not, they will wake up. He wanted to suggest that that's really what the two parts are. You have a Rosh Hashanah that attempts to awaken within us what we need to do, but that's the shofar. That's the get up, hello, wake up with an alarm. And comes along Hanukkah and does in a similar way try to awaken us. Perhaps we've already fallen asleep. We've already fallen back into our old habits, the way we were before Rosh Hashanah, and we need to be awakened awoken, probably awoken again. But this time we try a different approach. And that is we illuminate the room. We illuminate ourselves, not with the shofar blast of an alarm, but rather with this tremendous light that takes place. However, we all understand that for one to appreciate, to get anything out of any meaningful experience in life in general, which we'll talk about, but certainly when it comes to our Judaism, yeah, if you don't prepare for it and you just slide in right under the wire, just as, you know, my brother works for the Hatzalah. Hatzalah is the volunteer ambulance EMT service that are in many, many Jewish cities. My brother is an EMT or whatever. He's a first responder. So he told me a story that a couple of years ago, needless to say, he got a call. The call went out. Somebody needed help. And it was Erev Yom Kippur. It was like a couple of hours before Yom Kippur. And unfortunately, the patient needed to be taken to the hospital. So my brother was driving the ambulance, and he was one of the people taking care. Long story short, they have to take them down to Hopkins, not the closest hospital to where we are, but a good half hour away. And then you got to get settled and yada, yada. So by the time they finished with the patient, they literally had not even finished. They hadn't even eaten the meal before Yom Kippur. So in a funny way, he told me that the two guys in the front, they're driving their ambulance back from Hopkins and they're starving. And who wants to go into Yom Kippur starving? So they put on the lights and sirens and they zipped through all the red lights they could. And they stopped at 7-Eleven and picked up a couple of chocolate bars and some licorice, something, because it was like Yom Kippur was starting in 30 minutes. Like, now, fine. He finishes, drops off the ambulance. And of course, he slides into shul, all sweaty, all whatever, just in time for Kol Nidre. It sounds like a funny story, but more often than not, we're like that. How much did we really prepare to come into the holiday properly? So we know that's what, before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, most of us are good about it. And Rabbi Stavsky, all of us, Shalom, was so good at bringing it to the forefront for us to keep it in mind and not just wake up on Erev Rosh Hashanah. But what do we do about Hanukkah? How much do we prepare? We need to prepare. To get anything out of a holiday, you have to prepare. In fact, it's so interesting. Can someone tell me which parsha most years we read the Shabbos of Hanukkah? Which parsha in the Torah?
Vayigash.
Nope. That's sometimes, but not most times. It's the one right before it. Miketz. Miketz is the parsha that has that 99% of the 95% of the time is the parsha is always read Shabbos Chanukah. In that story of Miketz is the story of Yosef coming out because Pharaoh has his dream. Yosef is taken out of the prison, and he's now, you know, viceroy. And the whole story in the beginning of the brothers. So in there, in that parsha is the phrase Utvoach Tevach VeHochein, where it's talking about the animal, the slaughtering that they had prepared, that they had set out. They point out that the words Tevach VeHochein, if you look at the last letter, Tevach is a Chet. VeHochein, you take the Chet and the word VeHochein spells the word Chanukah. In the words of Parshat Miketz, the words Utvoach Tevach VeHochein, those last five letters spell the word Chanukah. But what's fascinating isn't just that it has the allusion to Chanukah. The word, the main part of the word is vehochein. Vehochein means and prepared. There needs to be a level of preparation to get something out of the holiday. Yes, it's beautiful. You stand before the menorah, you light it, you sing a couple of songs, maybe even you'll play a little dreidel. But what do you do? It doesn't seem to have any like massive spiritual boost. Well, it does if we prepare ourselves. And that's what I want to talk about. This concept of in Judaism in general, in life, the need for preparation. The more profound the experience, the more it's enhanced by preparation. You have to be able to prepare. What is preparation all about? If you think about it, it's mindfulness. If you're just going through the motions of something because it's on a checklist, so you're absent-minded. You do what you got to do. Mindfulness means you're making conscious decisions. I am thinking about what I'm doing. There's a self-awareness. One of the nicest things about when I love to run, I try to run, is I love it because I have my thoughts. I don't answer the phone, and I get to just think, clear my head, think about things that I'm not rushing, and I get to be mindful. What does this upcoming week, what do I need to deal with? What didn't I take care of? Not in an anxiety way, but it's mindfulness. The great Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, many of you know his works, either Derech Hashem, the Way of God, or more famous is Mesilat Yesharim, the Path of the Just. Great, great works that are classics. The Ramchal, when he discusses in Mesilat Yesharim, he talks about a ladder of ascending levels of spiritual achievement, of how you start with this, work on this trait, and then you work on that trait, and that's the building blocks for the next trait. And he has a whole ladder of how you go through it. Do you know what the very first rung on the ladder is? It's called in Hebrew, zihirut. Zihirut means self-awareness. Mindfulness.
Remember.
Pay attention. Huh?
Means from the word, same root as remember, zachar.
No, not zachar. Zihirut. Like you'll see a sign in Israel that tells you, zahir, beware, falling rocks.
Okay.
Zahir means to be aware, pay attention. Like the sign in America, you know, like what you have here in the States. Caution. Zahir means be careful. That means you're paying attention. Zihirut, the very first stage, the very first step of any kind of growth in life. Forget Judaism, but in life, you have to be mindful. We're not robots. We're not just supposed to go through the motions of it. There needs to be a sense of awareness. When the prophet Jeremiah is giving a certain level of musar, of rebuke to the Jewish people, he talks about those who are living this carefree life with not paying attention. If I can use the more modern example, the more modern expression of people who put their life on cruise control. It's just they're going through it, going through, and it's the same old, whatever. He uses the terminology. The prophet Jeremiah says, they're like a horse charging headlong into battle. The analogy is so spot on. Think about it. Picture the scene. You have an army, and you have these chariots, and you have these horses that the rider is on. And these horses, when the battle cry and everybody gives a kick and they gives them a whip, they are just going. They're not aware of what else is going on. They are singularly focused. Headlong into battle, regardless of what else is going on. There's no awareness of what's happening, but they are rushing headlong into it because they're caught up in the frenzy of the moment. There's no opportunity for them to take a step back and say, are we going the right way? Is this really what we should be doing? I don't blame the horse. I blame the rider. But when you go headlong, you know, head first into something, you have tunnel vision and you can't see the bigger picture. Life demands that we think about things. That's a requirement. It's not a luxury. Some people, oh, they were so good, they thought about what their decisions. It's not a luxury that we have an option. If we want something in life, we need to be mindful. Rabbi Wein would always tell us in high school, he'd tell the story about a fellow who was, of course, running late and he had to catch the train. And he wanted to go, I don't know, I think he gave the example, he wanted to go down south to Florida. But he's running late and he wants to catch the train and he rushes, he pays the ticket, he gets through the turnstile, he goes and just as the doors are closing, he squeaks in and he gets in and he's breathing a sigh of relief. Baruch Hashem. He sits down, he starts getting, calming down and cooling off and strikes up a conversation with the guy next to him. Oh, so very nice. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from this part. Yeah, great. And where are you heading? He says, I'm heading to New York. He says, New York? What do you mean? Isn't this the train going south to Florida? He said, no, this is the train north to New York. So the guy's like, oh, no. So what do? He picks up his bag and he starts running towards the back of the train. And he's running from car to car to car. Why? Because he wants to go south. So what does he do? So he's running and he's running. Obviously, it sounds so silly and so ridiculous, right? You're on the wrong train, dude. You got to get off that train and get on the right one. Rabbi Wein would use this as the analogy. Sometimes in life, we're going the wrong way. But who stops to think? Who stops? And even when we think, oh, okay, oh, well, I really should. So what do? We do a little token turnaround. It requires a sense of paying attention, of mindfulness. I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know tonight, but I'll show you so many different examples how in Judaism it plays such an important role of paying attention, of having that preparation to accomplish. I'll give you an example. What are the two main, the most essential prayers of the morning service, of Shachar? What are the two most critical parts of prayer?
Shema and Shemone Esrei.
Shema and Shemone Esrei. The Shema, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hero, right? Hero Israel. The Lord is our God. The Lord is one. And the Amidah, the 18, 19 blessings that we say. When we come to Shachar, and again, if this is if you're taking this as a personal rebuke, good, take it. If you are so, the way it's supposed to be, is you get to davening on time. If you were to be there on time, you will notice we do not start the prayer service with Shema. We do not start the prayer service with the Amidah. Why? Because you can't just slide in and have the most important conversation with God. We start with Birchot HaShachar. We start with a list of basic blessings, thanking God for a new day, giving me the ability that I can stand, giving me the ability that I have clothes to wear, that I can see, that I can hear the rooster crow to recognize the difference between day and night. You start with basics. And then you work your way up to Psukei Dezimra. You start talking about the greatness of God and the fact that God has mastery over the over natural world and that the celestial beings out there, the bodies, they also praise God. We can work our way and we start to get a focus. You can't just walk in and say Shema. You can't just walk in and say Shemona Esrei. Yeah. Technically, you can do it, but you're missing it. For you to get something out of it, our sages understood that. And therefore, they gave us the structure of the Siddur, that there's a structure to it. You know, if a person, I'll even tell you that in halacha, in basic Jewish law understands that situations arise and that you sometimes will come late. Pretty sure it doesn't say in parentheses, on a regular basis. It says, if a person came late, do you know that there are certain prayers you cannot skip? I'll give you an example. If a person comes late in the morning service, but he wants to be able to start the Shemona Esrei together with the congregation, which is the right thing, that's really You're supposed to be saying that prayer together with everybody. But if I came late, how am I supposed to catch up? So the halacha and Shulchan Aruch tells us very simply, certain prayers you absolutely have to say. In Psukei Dizimra, the regular morning brachos that you should say, if you say it at home, fine, but you should say them. But in far as the Psukei Dizimra, you have to say Baruch She'amar, Ashrei, and Yishtabach. Those three you cannot skip. Why? Rabbi, I have to get to Shema. I have to get to Shemona Esrei. My answer is, yes, you have to. But you can't come in bottom of the ninth, two out, three and two pitch and say, okay, I'm here to take a swing. It doesn't work that way. There are certain things you have to do. You have to at least have a basic format of preparation. That's what Baruch She'amar, Ashrei, and Yishtabach afford us. Is there more preparation needed? Yes. But if though, on the rare occasion when a person's late, our sages said, okay, this is sufficient. This is the at least the basic prep. But it's the right thing to do is to prepare. You can't do Shema and Shemona Esrei unless it's preceded with basics. I want to tell you an incredible story that I know personally. It happened to me. Okay? Bear with me, folks. It's one of my favorite stories about my father of blessed memory. Listen to this story. My father believed very much, and he lived his life on this principle of being prepared. It's how he lived his whole life. He was always prepared for his business meetings. He was always early for them. He always prepared. That's just the way he lived his life. And where it was manifest in a very meaningful way is that he would always come 10 minutes early to davening. 10 minutes before the official time for services. That was his thing. And he felt, like we're saying tonight, is that if you can't slide in. If services are at 9, you show up at 9 o'clock. He wants to be able to focus, get his mind clear from all everything else, and do it. So he was very particular to come 10 minutes early. That was his thing. And I can tell you many, many, many Sunday afternoons as I was watching the football games, and of course in the wintertime, sunsets very early, he would say to me, Tzvi, I'm heading to Mincha. I'm going to Mincha. I'm leaving in 10 minutes. I'm leaving in 10, 15 minutes, whatever it is. And of course, I'll be there, Dad, no problem. And of course, I'm watching the game. And Tzvi, I'm leaving in 5 minutes. I'll be there, Dad, no problem. Next play, next play. And of course, there was a penalty and called timeout. You know how it goes, right? And fine. All of a sudden, I look down and I'm like, oh, crud. And I go running up. And of course, my father had left. Now I really got a boogie because if I really was really late, I'd have to give an answer, a real good one. And football wasn't the right one. Fine. But I remember that was my father's thing, 10 minutes early. Keep this in mind. Let me fast forward to when he passed away. My father passed away on a Sunday evening. And my parents had made arrangements that they have plots in Israel. So my brother and I were going to escort my father to the cemetery in Israel. So he passed away Sunday evening. There was a funeral / eulogies Monday afternoon, early enough that we can catch a flight Monday evening from JFK to go to have the burial. We wanted it done before Tuesday evening. We wanted it done before sunset Tuesday. I'll explain another time. Halachically, it's best that if between the time of death and burial be as short as possible, and 2 days is fine. We wanted to keep it within 2 days. So here we are. We're flying to Israel. We leave Monday night, expecting to land in Israel approximately 4:30, maybe 5 o'clock on Tuesday. Sunset, if I remember correctly, was approximately 7:10 p.m. Approximately 7:10, if I remember correctly. Fine. We made arrangements with the burial society, the Chevra Kadisha. They were going to handle customs for the body. They told us, you get yourself to the cemetery. Don't worry about us. We'll take care of the mace. We'll take care of the deceased. You get yourself there. So my brother and I made arrangements. My cousins picked us up. Fine. We get into the car and they put in Waze. And it's real. First of all, if you ever have the opportunity to listen to Waze in Hebrew, it's hysterical. You think Israelis talk fast? Try Waze. Oh my gosh. But my cousins handle this, no problem. We're traveling along and Waze tells us that we're going to get there at 7:03. Okay? That's cutting it close. But that's what it is. There was a lot of traffic. They were doing construction. We knew that. They were doing construction on the road leading up to the cemetery. And it was fine. 7:03. Mm-hmm. We're traveling. And sure enough, we get to the point of where there's a lot of traffic. And we don't know what to do. Because, you know, time is really of the essence here. All of a sudden, on the left shoulder, we see an unmarked white van, not a cargo van, like a cargo van. In Israel, there's no such thing as a hearse like we have here where it says, you know, Saul Levinson and company, you know, or Epstein's or whatever it is. It's an unmarked white van. That's how they do it. And it's on the left shoulder. And all of a sudden, it crosses through the median. There's two-way traffic and you know, like a three-lane highway on both sides. And it crosses through the oncoming traffic and goes up a dirt path. Four of us, my two cousins in front, my brother and I in the back, and we're like, is it our father? Is it not? Is it going to the same cemetery? We have no idea, no clue. We don't know what to do. And finally, one cousin in front turns to the other and he says in Hebrew, Ani batuach, I'm positive. Zedod Yisrael, that's Uncle Yisrael. I'm positive. How do you know this? The other one says, Ani batuach. Taminoti. Believe, trust me. Okay. So now this, my cousin starts to try to cross the traffic. And of course, it's like the game of Frogger. The oncoming traffic's going in, out, trying to cross. And he makes it across. But guess what? Can't see the van anymore. We have no idea where it is. And my cousin looks and he sees like a dirt cloud up in the distance. He goes, look, it's a dirt cloud. Let's go. And we're going. We're trying to figure it out. Waze is going nuts because it has no idea where we are. It's trying to recalculate. It is, and it's probably cursing us out in Hebrew. I have no idea what it's saying. And we're trying and we're going up this hill and that hill. And look, there's the dust cloud. Anyway, long story short, we follow and we get onto a road, some road. And we go up the hill on this road. Waze recalculates and says we're now going to get to our destination at 6:53.
Wow.
It was my father. It was a shortcut going through, I don't even know whose field, but that was the shortcut there. And we were able to do everything we needed. Gentlemen. Wow. It's an amazing story, but what you haven't picked up on is exactly how many minutes early did we get there?
10
minutes earlier. There is no question in my mind that God said, Rabbi, my father, you gave me 10 minutes early every day. You gave me 10 minutes to prepare yourself to come before me properly on your most important day when you know time is of the essence. I'm going to give you 10 minutes. I'm telling you, if I had heard this story, I would, a cool story. It happened to me, guys. This was my story.
That's intense.
That's what it means to be prepared. I'm not saying it happens to everybody, but to me, it was crystal clear that God said, I'm going to give you the 10 minutes you always gave me. Very special moment in my life. But this concept, you know it also. When we want to take in Shabbat, do we go up against the clock? Do we say, okay, candle, you know, sunset is at 4:32, then okay, I'll light candles at 4:31. No, you don't. You do not do that. Why? Because you don't slide in just under the wire. You light candles 18 minutes earlier. You prepare yourself. And when you go to synagogue, Do you just start with the Maariv of service? No. You have Kabbalat Shabbat. You have songs that you sing. Get you into the frame of mind of what it means to be connecting to Shabbat. You prepared food ahead of time. You prepare yourself emotionally, physically. You take a shower, you shave, you put on a nice pair of clothing. That's what it means to be prepared. You don't just slide in for everything. If we want to gain things in life, and especially when it comes to spiritual matters, you have to prepare. You have to. But it gets better. I'll show you where else this comes up. How is it 9:45 already? Gosh. Okay. There's a parsha in the Torah called Parshat Shmini. Shmini, that's the name of the parsha. Why is it called Shmini? Because it means the eighth day. Why? So the Torah tells us that when the Mishkan, when the tabernacle was ready to be completed, the Torah says that Moshe was given the honor to put it up and take it down every day for 7 days. Almost like a dry run, a practice. He would put it up, it would stay up by day, and then he would take it down at night. And again, he would do that again for the following 6 days. So he did it for a total of 7 days, such that on the eighth day, it was erected and it remained erect until it was time for the Jews to travel when Hashem told them to take it down. They ask a very simple question. Why would you call it the eighth day? The first 7 days didn't accomplish anything. God's presence, God dwelling as a, you know, the divine presence didn't happen until the last day. Days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 were nothing more than dry run. They were practice. If you were to ask me, when was the first effective day of the tabernacle? I would say what we call the eighth day, I would have called day one. That's the anniversary of when the effectiveness, it became a functional tabernacle. 1 through 7, that just happened to be prep. That was just a dry run in practice. Says the Torah is teaching us a critical and critical point. And that is the 7 days may have been practice. They may have been a dry run, but they are an essential part of the fulfillment of the mitzvah. The preparing for the mitzvah is not just something separate that you just have to do, but the mitzvah is the most important. No, says the Torah. Preparing for the mitzvah is part and parcel of the mitzvah. That's why it's called the eighth day, because the first 7 days were part of the mitzvah too. It puts the mitzvah in the proper perspective. It enables the person to perform the mitzvah in its optimum fashion. Because if you don't prepare and you just slide in to do it at the last second, you're just going to do it. Plopple it. When you prepare for it, then it becomes real. You've thought about it. You've thought about how's the best way to do this. I'm very much a thinker like that. It's something my wife laughs at me all the time. It could be whatever time, 1 o'clock in the morning, we're going to bed and she's done. Her brain has been off since 11 and she's just done for. I'll get into bed and all of a sudden I want to wax poetic or I have some philosophical. And she'll look at me and she's like, do you know how to turn it off? Like, is there an off button somewhere? But that's just how my brain works. I'm like thinking about, you know, I was thinking about it when our grandkids, why are you thinking about this at 1 in the morning? But that's how my head works. But that it just means mindfulness. This relates to the menorah itself. I'll tell you a fascinating law. I'm going to ask you this as a question. Tell me, please, in detail, what is the mitzvah relating to the menorah that took place in the tabernacle or the temple, the Beit HaMikdash? What was the mitzvah? Please tell me. What did they do? All of a sudden, everybody's all nervous that this is a trick question. What is the mitzvah with the menorah?
They kept the Ner Tami going.
Okay, but what was the mitzvah? What did they do?
Rededicating the temple?
I'm not talking about the holiday of Hanukkah. I'm talking about just every day that went on in the Beit HaMikdash. There was a mitzvah relating to the menorah. What did they do?
They lit it.
They lit the menorah. Thank you, Fred. You guys are just way. You guys are too nervous that I'm asking you something like philosophically deep that it's too late at night to think about. It's a simple question. Lighting the menorah every single day. Was there any other part of that mitzvah?
Well, they had to clean it out.
Thank you, Mr. B. Thank you. I'll give you the perfect example. On the second night of Hanukkah, when you want to put in the new candle, so you have one in the new spot and then one in the old spot. 9 out of 10 times, you can't get the new candle in that first spot because there's still wax from last night. Or if you use oil, you still got to get rid of the wick. There's an element that you have to clean it out. Jim, true or false, the cleaning of the menorah was part and parcel of the mitzvah.
Yes, true.
You say true. Okay. So here's where it's fascinating. I would even argue that it might even be the cleaning out of the menorah was even more important. And I'll show you an interesting law. Okay. Jim, you're not a Kohen, are you?
No.
If you were given the honor of lighting the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, could you or could you not do it?
Probably not.
That was said with such confidence. Could not, I think.
I'm guessing only Kohanim could light.
What do you think? Brad, what do you think? Could a non-Kohen light the menorah?
In the Mishkan?
Either one. Mishkan, Beit HaMikdash. What?
Say yes.
You would say a non-Kohen could.
Oh, yeah.
How about cleaning? Cleaning out the menorah. Can a non-Kohen do it?
Sounds like good support staff. The cleaning operation.
The correct answer, by the way, is that a non-Kohen is not allowed to light the menorah. Only a Kohen can do it. But strangely enough, a non-Kohen could go ahead and clean it out. Yes, I would be able to do it. I, the non-Kohen, would be allowed to have that honor of cleaning the menorah. Now, you'll say to me, hey, doesn't that prove that the lighting of the menorah is more important because that's relegated for only a Kohen? One could argue that, but I would argue the opposite. The Kohen can't light the menorah until I do my job of cleaning it out. He can't even light it until I do it first. My cleaning it out is part and parcel that allows the mitzvah to be done. He can't do it without me.
Is there a mitzvah to clean the menorah?
Yes.
Yes.
Today?
No. No.
I got a lot of wax.
If you can somehow squeeze that candle in without taking out the wax, you're a lucky guy. Most of us plebes have to clean it out every night.
Take a night.
I mean, you're a lady, so you're close. Mm-hmm. But the part and parcel. Now, here's something else interesting. Let's skip to Yom Kippur for a second. We know that on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is the one who did all of the services, right? He had to wear white clothing when he went into the Holy of Holies because he couldn't wear gold clothing, right? We know all this stuff, fine. One of the biggest challenges to the service of Yom Kippur that happened in Jewish history was a major argument between, in English, they're called the Sadducees. These were a group of Jews who did not accept anything from the oral Torah. They took the literal Torah. They took the written Torah literally, and that's all they did, and that's how they interpreted it. They didn't accept any, no Gemara, no Midrash, nothing. It's straight written Torah. And the rabbis who understood that the written Torah was part and parcel together with the oral Torah. Where this played a major role is when the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur had to bring in Hebrew, we call it the Ketoret, the incense. He had a pan that had coals on it, and he was to put spices, certain mixture of ketoret, on it. And it would be a fragrant incense burning that would to be done in the Holy of Holies. There was a disagreement between the rabbis and the Sadducees. What is the correct procedure? Do you put the spices, meaning do you light the coals, have it, and put the spices on it so that it generates smoke on the outside and walk in with it already burning, which is what the Sadducees said? Or do you do it inside, meaning take just the pan in one hand, the spices in the other, and in the Holy of Holies, put the spices on it to generate the smoke? This was a major disagreement between them. The Sadducees said you light it outside and bring it in. The Torah's understanding, the rabbis, the way I understood it, was no, that you did it in the Holy of Holies itself. What is the crux of the issue? The crux of the issue, the argument, is whether the preparation is an essential part of the mitzvah itself or not. The Sadducees said, no, it's not part of the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to have the incense smoke in the Holy of Holies. The fact that you got to put it all done and make it all happen beforehand, that's done outside. That's just preparation. The rabbi said, no, you misunderstand. The preparation is part of the mitzvah, and therefore it's all done in the Holy of Holies. You have the pan of coals and the spices, and in the Holy of Holies, you're preparing it now in the Holy of Holies, and that's how the Kohen Gadol would do it. That's the crux of the issue. Whether the preparation is part and parcel of the mitzvah, we, the Torah observant Jewish people, believe that that is part of the mitzvah itself. So we're left with the question, so how are we going to prepare for Hanukkah? Because that's ultimately the question. I set you up, and now you understand we need to prepare. And we still have 3 weeks. We have 3 weeks, gentlemen. We can do this. What should we focus on? So I'll tell you very quickly. I'm going to share with you what is not the standard understanding. And I apologize if it's going to scramble your brain waves, because you've never heard this before. At least I don't think so. And it's going to change your perspective on the whole story. What happened? What was the miracle that happened? Everybody knows that story. The Jews, the Maccabees, right? They were able to defeat. They were able to defeat the Greek army, and they went and they rededicated the temple, and they were looking and looking to try to relight the menorah, and they couldn't find any oil except for one jug of oil that they found, and they were lighting it, they poured it, and miraculously it lasted for 8 days. Is that a fair, did I get that right? Okay. I want to share with you the words of the actual story in the Gemara, in the Talmud. Okay? I'm going to read it to you, because I don't want to be accused of making stuff up. Here's what it says. My Hanukkah. The Talmud asks, what is the basic storyline of Hanukkah? B'chafei b'kislev yomei d'chanukkah. On the 25th day of Kislev, those are the days of Hanukkah. That's when they commence. There are 8 days in all. Why? On which it's not permitted to do certain things. Why? Okay, because what happened is that when the Syrian Greeks entered the sanctuary, they contaminated all the flasks of oil that were in the sanctuary. And when the royal Hasmonean house gained the upper hand and vanquished them, the Hasmoneans searched the Heichal area and found only one flask of oil. I'm going to read you the words. Badku, they searched, like Bedikat Chametz, they searched. Velo Matzu, and they did not find, Ella, only, Pach Echad Shel Shemen. I'll just translate it loosely the way most people do. And the only thing they found was one jug of oil, one flask of oil that was lying out of sight with the Kohen Gadol's seal still intact. And it contained only enough to kindle the menorah for one day. A miracle happened. They lit it and it kindled for 8 days. Therefore, the following year, right? They decided, Sanhedrin and the Chashmonaim established, rendered these 8 days as permanent festivals with respect to Halal and Hodah for Halal and Thanksgiving. Okay. I didn't tell you anything you don't know yet, right? I want you to listen carefully to this, to these words again. Budku, they searched, v'lo matzu, and they did not find, Ella only, hach echad shel shemen. One jug of oil is how they translate it. But if you know Hebrew, that's not really the literal translation. Because how do I say the following? I just want to draw the contrast. Is there a difference to say a jug of oil, which is describing the contents of the jug? It's a jug of oil as opposed to a jug of orange juice, right? What if I wanted to make the emphasis not on the contents of the jug, but what kind of jug it was? It was an oil jug as opposed to a, I don't know, a balsamic vinegar jug. In Hebrew, you have to differentiate. In English, you hear the difference? An oil jug or a jug of oil? You hear the difference?
Sure.
Well, there has to be a way to say that in Hebrew too. How do they differentiate between a jug of oil versus an oil jug?
It's descriptive.
It is descriptive of the jug, not the contents. Sure. So in Hebrew, if I want to describe and I want to say a jug of oil, I would say pach shemen. I would take out the word shell. It would just say pach shemen, jug of oil. That's what, as I would say it. If I wanted to describe it, an oil jug, I would say it's a pach, it's a jug, shel shemen, of an oil base, as opposed to something else. The words pach shel shemen almost indicate not that there was oil in it, but they found an oil jug. And you know what was in it? Nothing. It was empty. You're all looking at me like I'm from Mars. And I get it. I didn't anticipate you to agree with this. The words, pach, they found pach echad shel shemen, one jug. What kind of jug? Shel shemen, an oil jug. Not a jug of oil. That's not how you would say it in Hebrew. You wouldn't say pach shel shemen. You would say pach shemen. You wouldn't describe it that way. So it would come out, based on this understanding, the miracle was they found an empty jug that still had the seal of the Kohen Gadol, meaning the jug itself was still pure, did not become impure, but there was no oil in it whatsoever. And you say, okay, then what did they do? Yeah. Now I'll tell you exactly what the miracle was. They took that empty jug and they wanted to light the menorah. So they took it and guess what? All of a sudden it filled with oil and it enough for one night. It finished it. Guess what happened to that jug the second night? Filled with oil again. And the third night and the fourth night. But it included the first night also. It was empty. You're like, what? I never heard that. Come on, you're making this stuff up. Could be. But it's something to think about. Think about it. And I'll tell you why I'm sharing this. Because the concept of what we can work on for Hanukkah is the sense of, let me say it better, is looking humility and what we call in Hebrew, bitul hayesh, and a nullification of yourself. One of the things that we are grappling with as people is that we become so full of ourselves. We are, I don't want to go so far as to say arrogant, but at the end of the day, we all have tremendous talents. Some are great speakers. Some are great athletes. Some are great, whatever it is. But is that something that you developed all on your own? Or was it a talent you were born with that thankfully you were able to nurture and get out and to bring out into reality. But it was a potential that lied within you that you were given as a gift. Where did you get that gift? God gave it to you. It's an inborn talent that you were given. Each one of us has those talents. What we have to look at is we have to look at ourselves as if we were an empty jug. We are empty jugs. And it's only God who gives us talents and abilities. The same way he filled the empty jug with oil that miraculously burned for 8 days, he miraculously gives us talents and abilities that we also have to bring out. There's a halacha. How close to the ground should you be lighting your Chanukiah? How close to the ground should you really be lighting it? If you've ever been to Israel or seen pictures, they all light it outside by the doorpost, right? The mezuzah on one side and the menorah on the other side. But where? On a big table high? No. It's close to the ground. It's very close to the ground. It's on maybe a little step stool. Why? Because the halacha is, where does it really belong? It needs to be within 10 tfachim to the ground. It's on a low point. You say, why? The whole point is to publicize the miracle. Let's put it up there huge. Show everybody. Because to really appreciate Hanukkah, there needs to be an element of lowliness, a sense of humility that what I have in my life are gifts. I can't take full credit for what I do. I can't take full credit that I became this or I accomplished that. I'm not saying we shouldn't take pride in our accomplishments. That's not what I'm saying. But don't delude yourself into thinking you're God's gift to everything and you did it all by yourself. You were given a gift. The more you recognize that I'm an empty vessel, that I have been blessed with things in my life, the more you recognize that, the more gifts will be given to you. That's how you prepare properly. What do we use in the menorah? We use olive oil. The Torah uses a very strange expression. It's called shemen zayit, olive oil, zach, which means pure, kasis, means crushed, pulverized. Extra, extra, extra virgin olive oil. How do they get it so pure? They crush it. And you know what? The oil that they used for lighting the menorah and the Beit HaMikdash, do you know how much of the olive oil that got from each olive, what was allowed to be used?
One drop.
The first drop. That's it. That is the purest of the pure. That first squeeze. That's what is the most pure. Yeah. We have to look at ourselves as empty that we are blessed to be filled with. If we think we filled our own jug, we're missing the point. The preparation, I believe, for Hanukkah is this concept. The humility to recognize that whatever we do have is really a gift from God. And there's no reason to feel that sense of arrogance, that sense of haughtiness. Budku. They went looking, they searched, and that's what we have to do. Look deep within ourselves. Velomatsu. And at the end of the day, you know what? They didn't find. They weren't necessarily worthy. They weren't necessarily, they did great things, but they approached it and said, after all is said and done, I'm still empty. God, please help me here. Grace me. Give me another gift. The more we realize that, the more we will be blessed with it. And that perhaps is the deeper meaning of when it says that they searched and they only found pach echad shel shemen, one oil jug. Okay? There was no oil necessary. I know that's not the classic understanding, but enough to get you to think. Enough to think that maybe there is something more to this holiday and that if we're going to get something out of it, and God willing, in 3 weeks' time, we're going to go ahead and we're going to light the menorah. and we're going to try to learn something from it. Don't wake up that night. Don't wake up then. Don't even wake up 2 days before. Start now. What does light mean to you? We're living in a time of darkness. This is the war that the Jewish people are facing right now. There is darkness. This is the Yontif that's going to illuminate. This is the holiday that we have the opportunity to show the world what is right, what is correct, what is moral. We need to illuminate the darkness. But if you want it to be right, if you want it to be worthwhile, like everything else in life, the more profound the experience, the more it needs preparation. Let's work on it. In a few weeks, we'll talk about another aspect of Hanukkah. But don't wake up in 3 weeks. Start now. Start to think, what is it that you want to get out of Hanukkah? What's a lesson? Go online. Go look up a nice thought on Hanukkah. Not then. Do it now. That's the preparation that's necessary to prepare for every holiday, especially Hanukkah, that has the potential, like Rosh Hashanah, to awaken within us where the shofar did it with an alarming sound. On Hanukkah, we get the opportunity to illuminate that within us. That's what we have the opportunity for.
Amen.
Something to think about. Questions? Ideas? It's different. It's a very different way of thinking of it.
Anything particular to look for? Thoughts on Hanukkah or just...
I don't know. I mean, there's so much that you can. I don't have anything in particular. I mean, I'm preparing something for when we meet. Speaking of which, let's talk about that for a second. In 2 weeks, let's just take a quick look here. 2 weeks puts us... What does that put us? That puts us on December 3rd. Ooh, I have a wedding.
You want to meet at the wedding?
Yeah. is it too much to ask if we pushed it to Hanukkah itself?
No.
Sunday
we'll
the 10th.
Busy preparing.
You'll be prepared by then. Nice try.
About 10 minutes before Hanukkah.
Yes.
Steve, you like that story, huh? Isn't that an unbelievable story? I'm telling you, it hit me like a ton of bricks that day. On the airplane ride back to the States, right after the funeral, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Couldn't believe it. Okay, so let's do this. Unless the majority of you can't do it, let's push it instead of 2 weeks on the 3rd. Let's meet on the 10th so we can actually talk on Hanukkah itself, a lesson that we can learn. Does that work, Jim?
Okay,
fine.
Sure.
Perfect. All right.
Who's got to bring the Sitkan Yot?
The 10th.
Yeah. All right.
Two weeks after that, we'll meet on Christmas Eve. I'm kidding.
And we'll play cards, Jim.
But why don't we do the 17th just to make up?
Oh.
We'll do back to back so we can stay on the regular schedule. We'll do the 10th and the 17th, and then we'll meet after.
The 10th is a CTA dinner.
Oops.
Ah. Last till 9?
Wow.
Probably about that, 9:30. What do you think? I don't know. Starts at 7.
Oh.
I mean, I guess I can try. I mean, I know I think mine is a 5 o'clock wedding.
No.
I don't want to miss. I want to do another one on Hanukkah, though.
Well, could we do it on a Monday night?